James, he's got it. Coming to the end of the third quarter. LeBron James, a shot at history.
The call last night when LeBron James became the NBA's all-time leading scorer with 38,390 points and counting. He did it on a fadeaway jumper from near the free throw line in a home game against the Oklahoma City Thunder. He surpassed the record set by another Laker, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, 39 years ago. Abdul-Jabbar was there last night to congratulate James. Here to talk about this historic moment and the player heralded now as the greatest of all time is Dave Schilling. He's contributing writer for the LA Times Image Magazine. Hi.
Hello.
Well, you were watching the game from home last night. What was it like in those moments after he made that basket?
Well, they stopped the game for like 10 minutes so that he could give a speech. And the Lakers were in a game that they were trying to win to get into the playoffs. I was flabbergasted by the whole thing. It was a lot of pomp and circumstance, but it was a great moment to get to witness live.
Right. I mean, there were tribute videos from Snoop Dogg, Magic Johnson, Drake. But there was also this really touching moment when, LeBron broke the record. And like we said, Abdul-Jabbar was there and he got up and he handed over the ball as kind of like a ceremonial passing of the torch in a way.
It definitely felt like that. It felt like Kareem was very happy to be there. LeBron was exhausted, overwhelmed with the moment, and probably a little bit focused on the game still. But it was really lovely to get to see one Laker legend pass this torch on to a new Laker legend.
Yeah, and so Abdul-Jabbar retired in 89 with three fewer points. And so his record has stood, I guess, for more than three decades now. So talk about the significance of that and why it took so long to break it and why it sort of necessitated a singularly talented player like James, a kind of once-in-a-generation player. He's been in the league since he was 18 to break it.
Well, I think you hit on the issue there, is that he came into the league when he was 18 years old. And that is something that is not particularly common, to be able to be athletically gifted enough and mature enough to come into the NBA out of high school. You know, you're still a child when you graduate from high school in a lot of ways. You haven't fully matured to the level that people in their 20s, early 20s, are when they come into the NBA. So he was able to play at a high level for a long, long, long time. A lot of the people that he passed suffered injuries. Karl Malone was not able to play at a high level as long as LeBron. Carmelo Anthony is no longer in the league. Shaquille O'Neal broke down because he was just so large, so physically imposing that his body couldn't handle the stress for as long as LeBron has been able to play basketball as an MVP caliber player.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of thinking about that myself. I mean, one of the sort of defining character, I mean, there are so many of his storied career, but one of them is that he has been able to avoid injury in a way that a lot of players are not. And so he has been able to play at this incredible level for so long.
Yeah, you know, you think about Kobe Bryant, who was arguably the most popular Laker of the last generation, the last decade or 20 years or so. He suffered a torn Achilles in a game and was never the same player that he was before. He couldn't jump as high. He couldn't explode to the basket the same way. He turned his game into a real perimeter game, a kind of an old man on the playground sort of game. If you've ever played pickup basketball, you know, there's that one guy who's like pushing 40, who just has moves that you would not expect from a person of that age. And Kobe knew so much about basketball that he could keep playing at a high level, but not quite the level that he did when he was a top flight player. LeBron hasn't had that. He has played countless minutes through the playoffs into the summer, pretty much every year of his career, certainly with Miami, the second time with Cleveland, and maybe not so much with the Lakers, unfortunately. We haven't been nearly as good as we want to be. But he did win a championship in 2020, and that was one of the most remarkable seasons in NBA history because there was that massive break from the time the league was shut down because of the COVID outbreak to the bubble period of the league in Orlando. there was a chance he could have hurt himself in training. He could have hurt himself because he wasn't playing basketball for this long stretch of time. But he's kept going. His longevity is off the charts.
Well, and he's no spring chicken. He's 38 years old, which doesn't sound very old to the average person. But for a professional athlete who is putting their body really through the works day in and day out, year after year, that is a lot. It's a lot to take. And so, you know, there's talk of him being the first player to reach 40,000 points. What will it take for him to reach that?
He's going to have to keep playing on a team that's as bad as the Lakers, first of all. He's going to have to keep scoring. And he's not the only option on this Lakers team right now. Obviously, Anthony Davis was having an MVP season until he hurt himself. He had a foot injury that kept him out for a few weeks. Russell Westbrook is certainly a high-volume shooter when he's on the court, much to the dismay of many Laker fans. But LeBron is still the first option when he's on the court. And so I think as long as he's playing on a team that needs him to the level the Lakers need him, he's going to be able to score a lot of points. I'm 38 years old, and I have a hard enough time picking up my son sometimes, but LeBron James will probably be able to play into his early 40s because of his strength training, because of the advances in sports science. I think he can get to 40,000 points pretty easily.
Well, and so you touched on it a little bit, but the Lakers have not been having a stellar time the past couple of years. And James has been really instrumental in helping shape the roster. So I guess what's kind of next for him? I mean, he seems like he's proven to be a better player than a kind of manager of sorts when it comes to figuring out like how to stack a team for a championship.
Yeah, I would say most players of his ability level are not great at building teams. You look at Michael Jordan, who owns the Charlotte Hornets, and they haven't really contended for a title ever. Magic Johnson was an all-time great player, maybe not a great general manager of the Lakers. So if LeBron really is kind of managing this team in some way or dictating terms about rosters, he's not doing a good job.
And I guess, like, what does that mean for the final years of James's, you know, NBA career? I mean, he's probably in the twilight of it. He's not announced any plans to retire. He's still playing at a top level. But in terms of what we just talked about, the kind of quality of play the Lakers are able to put on the court day in and day out, what does that mean for his final years in the league? And is he maybe going to go out on a little bit of a whimper more than a bang?
Well, I think there are two things that LeBron James wants to accomplish before he retires. Number one is to win a fifth championship. Magic Johnson has five. Kobe had five. Kareem had five or has five. That's a big deal for him. The number of championships he wins compared to Michael Jordan gives his case for the greatest of all time more weight. The other thing he wants to accomplish is to play with his son. And Bronny James, LeBron James Jr., is currently in high school at Sierra Canyon, and he's fielding offers for where he might go to college. He has to play in college 1 year in order to be eligible for the NBA draft based on the current rules that exist. That means that LeBron James in 2024 will have an opportunity to sign with a team that drafted his son, and maybe he plays one more year with his son. So I think those are the two things that he's weighing at this point, whether or not he can win another championship and where his son is going to end up in the NBA.
But James also has other aspirations beyond basketball. He's been dabbling in Hollywood. I mean, talk about that and how he's kind of setting himself up, too, for his future.
Yeah, I mean, he has Spring Hill Entertainment, which I believe is currently fielding offers for a sale or that sale's already happened. He had House Party come out. He did Space Jam 2, he has The Shop on HBO. He has all of these things that he's doing that are related to outside the court activities. And being in LA allows him to be a bit closer to that, to kind of network when he's on the court. You know, if you have Ari Emanuel from Endeavor courtside, they could talk business during timeouts or during halftime or something. Like, that's the beauty of a Laker game, is it's sort of like lunch at the Polo Lounge or something.
Hey, you signed that contract?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, Dave Schilling is a contributing writer for the LA Times Image Magazine. Dave, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Saudi Arabia is trying to make its mark in American sports and filmmaking. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the Kingdom's Public Investment Fund recently signed a deal with the CW Network to air Live Golf, a rival to the PGA. Hollywood is filming more and more blockbusters in the region, and Saudi Arabia recently hosted a star-studded film festival featuring some of this year's Oscar nominees. Saudi Arabia faced pushback for its human rights record in the wake of the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But now that pushback seems to be waning as the country once again tries to make inroads into American entertainment. Joining us to talk about all of this is Alex Weprin. He covers business and the media for The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Alex.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So how long has this been going on, the Saudi push to invest in American entertainment?
It's been on and off for many years now. Obviously, after Khashoggi's murder, it did kind of stop. But in the last couple of years, really since the pandemic, it's picked up.
And give us a sense of the ties that they're trying to build, not just in American media, but also just more broadly Western media. We mentioned Live Golf's agreement with the CW. Soccer superstar Cristiano Ronaldo is coming to play for one of the country's teams for $200 million a year. What else are they investing in right now?
Yeah, so it's a combination of public investments and private investments. You know, on the public side, the Saudi Public Investment Fund is buying significant shares in companies like Live Nation, which owns Ticketmaster, and some video game companies like Take-Two Interactive and EA. And on the private side, as you said, they've kind of created Live Golf, this PGA competitor. They've financed the Red Sea Film Festival, which is a big film festival that's a priority in the country. They've provided credits to kind of make film and television productions in the country attractive. So they're kind of making a multifaceted push in both the private side of things with investments like Live Golf and the public sector by just buying stock in big American public companies.
And on the face of it, it seems kind of a head scratcher, I guess, because culturally, Saudi Arabia is a very conservative nation. It's very religious. Practices a strict form of Islam. It's a significant part of the country's identity. They're an autocratic state. It was only a few years ago even that women were allowed to start driving again. And Hollywood culture is not that. So explain the Saudi interest in Hollywood.
I mean, the Saudi crown prince, he's got an interest in kind of creating the future. He's got this mega city project in the country that he wants to be an idea for how cities should be in the future. He's very interested in Hollywood himself. He's interested in sports. Greg Norman, the legendary golfer who's the CEO of Live Golf, has said quite openly that the country views golf as kind of a form of a diplomatic, it's kind of a part of diplomacy for them. So it's all part of the puzzle there. It's a priority for the crown prince, so it's a priority for the government.
The kind of winning hearts and minds, I guess, that will, you know, entice visitors, tourism, all that kind of stuff, right?
Exactly.
So beyond money, I mean, you mentioned the Public Investment Fund. This is valued at hundreds of billions of dollars. What is the appeal of Saudi Arabia from Hollywood? Or does it really just boil down to the money?
You know, at this moment in time, you know, the pandemic really changed the equation for a lot of these companies. Money is necessary. And right now, with an uncertain economy, it can be hard to find financing. Debt financing is much harder to come by now. As a result, if there's an institution, and the PIF is a large institutional investor that has money and is willing to spend it, it can be appealing to a lot of companies. If you're kind of developing a feature film that is more of an independent mid-budget film, it can be hard to get that made, but Saudi Arabia is offering really, you know, interesting incentives to try and get it made in the country that can, you know, allow you to actually get it done. But it really is being driven by the finances.
You know, we mentioned the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who wrote for The Washington Post. That was really a flashpoint in Hollywood's relationship with Saudi Arabia at the time. We saw a lot of people pulling out of their ties to the country. And you mentioned the pandemic as this big moment that changed that relationship. But what happened? I mean, how has that just been sort of cast aside? Might be a little bit flip, but what changed?
The pandemic forced these companies to really have to transform their businesses and figure out how to make it work when movie theaters were closed, when productions were shut down, when touring was shut down. So they needed financing, and Saudi Arabia was willing to step in and make these big investments into American companies. You know, as time goes on and we get further from Khashoggi's murder, it becomes a little easier to kind of put that aside and think about a deal in a moment of necessity. I don't think a lot of companies would be necessarily eager to do it, But if it's an opportunistic deal and it's needed to help save your business, companies will do it.
So is anyone significantly pushing back on this growing involvement, though? Because, I mean, Khashoggi's killing is just among the human rights violations that Saudi Arabia is accused of. It still jails dissidents. It's been accused of launching unlawful airstrikes that have killed and wounded thousands of people in Yemen amid an ongoing civil war there. Is anybody really voicing those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I would look just to the LIV Golf deal with the CW network. The CW is owned by Nexstar, which is a big owner of local TV stations in the United States. They have thousands of journalists at those local TV stations. So the National Press Club, they urged Nexstar to, quote, do the right thing and cancel their bloody golf show. But thus far, at least with LIV Golf, you know, it hasn't really slowed them down. You know, the PGA Tour is pushing back, but the PGA's pushback is also opportunistic because LIV Golf is also challenging them on their business. So, you know, there is pushback, but thus far, it doesn't seem to be stopping any major deals from getting done.
Yeah, I mean, Nexstar didn't pull out, and there was an interview with the CEO of LIV, Greg Norman, and his quote was, I've been over there building a golf course in Saudi Arabia. Now this is way before any of this hoo-ha-ha erupted. I mean, that's feels a little bit dismissive of the murdering of a renowned journalist.
It is. And, you know, LIV has been able to build a business essentially by taking, you know, Greg Norman, who is a very famous golfer, and he's offered, you know, high eight-figure and nine-figure deals to some very famous golfers to have them leave the PGA and go to LIV. They're still taking those deals despite all of this.
So how is Saudi Arabia, I guess, and Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, how are they, I guess, I don't know, easing concerns that other Hollywood types might have? I mean, we mentioned the Red Sea Film Festival in the intro. This was this big Hollywood film festival that they just had. There was a star-studded red carpet there. So clearly something is working on their behalf. I mean, I know we talked a lot about the money, but people seem willing to kind of put their faces out there and say that they're, I guess, you know, willing to start looking at Saudi Arabia as a place for big budget movies and all of this stuff.
You know, Hollywood is no stranger to rehabilitating people that do not have the best reputations. As we've seen numerous times over the years, if you get the right people in the room, it can send a message to others in the business that, okay, maybe this is okay now. Maybe we can talk to them again. And so that seems to be what's happening.
So 10 years from now, will Saudi Arabia basically be like China, where they're funding a lot of American entertainment, movies are being crafted and re-edited in part to appeal to China? Is that kind of where you see things headed in the next decade?
It's certainly possible. One quirk with China is that there is legislation in Congress to try and stop Hollywood studios from working with any companies affiliated with the Chinese government, which is pretty much all of the entertainment companies in that country. But yeah, I mean, we are kind of shifting in that direction. You know, as the budgets get more expensive for films and TV shows, the desire to kind of make them work around the world could push more partnerships with other countries, including some that have values that really don't align with ours.
Alex Weprin is a media and business writer for The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.
Guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend earlier and more aggressive treatment for kids who are overweight. We'll talk to a doctor about them next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Alloy. Here in the U.S., nearly 20% of kids ages 2 to 19 are considered obese, a number that has been ticking up and up for decades now. Childhood obesity is a serious national health concern. It puts kids at risk for developing health conditions like high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and breathing problems like asthma. And it's why the American Academy of Pediatrics last month updated its treatment guidelines to recommend earlier and more aggressive interventions for kids who are overweight, including weight loss drugs and even bariatric surgery for kids who are severely overweight. It's those recommendations that have prompted serious debate about how intense is too intense and whether kids and their families are ready for the kinds of lifelong commitments that come with those treatments. For more on what the guidelines mean for kids and parents, we've invited Dr. Dennis Stein. He's the Yochidei Chair of Pediatric Endocrinology and Professor of Pediatrics at UC Davis. Welcome to Press Play.
Well, thank you very much, Michelle.
Well, how big of a shift are these treatment guidelines from the previous recommendations?
So the basis for approaching childhood overweight and obesity is always lifestyle changes. That's one of the reasons we're in this predicament right now, because we have changed what children eat and how much activity they have. Now we say if lifestyle modification doesn't work well enough, we increase the treatment to pharmacology and for surgery. And that is a recent shift because we've received enough information now knowing that these modalities work well. And the medications have been investigated, but only recently, in the last few years, have been approved for use in children.
And you weren't part of the team of doctors who drafted these recommendations, but do you agree with the more aggressive approach here? And why? I mean, it sounds like you do, and that we've, to some extent, been doing this for a couple years now.
Yes, I wasn't part of these guidelines. I was part of the Endocrine Society guidelines from 2017. At that time, we discussed the use of bariatric surgery or surgery for the treatment of obesity and the use of pharmacotherapy, but we didn't have enough information to go as far as these guidelines. So yes, I absolutely agree with them because we know that lifestyle modification doesn't always have its intended effects and we have to go further. When a child has type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, or elevated cholesterol levels, or liver damage due to fat deposition to the liver, we have to think of the best way to take care of these problems, and to eliminate some of the weight that caused these problems is one of the approaches. So surgery and pharmacology can help in this matter if the lifestyle changes have not taken their effects.
And what are the long-term risks of those conditions you mentioned?
Oh, type 2 diabetes is a very common condition now in adults, as you probably know, across the world. There are millions and millions of people in every country. In the past, we never thought that would affect children, but probably 30 years ago, perhaps, or a little bit longer, the first teenagers were being reported with type 2 diabetes in childhood when we thought it didn't affect anyone under perhaps 25 years of age. This has devastating effects in childhood, and we have a progression in childhood from oral medications, which is often how we start treatment, to injected insulin. Hyperlipidemia or high cholesterol levels is well known to affect heart disease, and we're worried about the future of children with elevated lipid levels.
The weight loss drugs you mentioned, the FDA recently approved some of them for adults. And like we've been talking about, the American Academy of Pediatrics is now recommending them for kids 12 and older, coupled with, you know, behavioral therapy. But what do we know about how effective they are for kids and whether they're safe for long-term use?
Luckily, at this point, we have some very good studies, controlled studies across the world with some of these medications, and that's why the FDA has approved them recently. And the side effects are generally not too severe, and that's why the FDA was allowed to approve it. In adults, when you stop taking the medication, very frequently weight loss recurs, and these studies in children also suggest that a short period of time after stopping the medication, you can see an increase in weight once again.
So these have are to be taken for a lifetime. I mean, realistically, yes. That's what we're talking about. This is a lifetime commitment, and our kids ready for that? Are families ready for that?
Well, families who understand the serious nature of their children's comorbidities or conditions that accompany the obesity, I hope will understand that treatment will be necessary in the long term to keep those conditions or comorbidities off of the child's diagnostic list. So I think if they see the effects of the medication or the effects of the bariatric surgery, they will support that.
Well, and so how do we talk about this with families? Because kids aren't in control of their diets in a lot of ways. They're not the ones going grocery shopping. They're kind of subject to whatever they're receiving for school lunch. They do not have control in a lot of ways over all of the types of foods that they're consuming. That really comes down to the parents. So how do these recommendations account for the shifts families are going to have to make to support their child if this is the treatment that is recommended for them?
This is family-directed treatment. The whole family must be involved. The family can't say, oh, one of the children is a bit heavier and the others are not. We can't deprive the other children of the diet. We've changed the heavier child to follow. Well, in fact, all of them can benefit from a healthy diet. So you have to include the whole family in the activity.
And I think, you know, any family wants to support their kid, right? But are these expectations... realistic might be a harsh word, but, you know, in this country, there is a direct correlation between your weight and your socioeconomic status. I mean, even for kids, the CDC says that kids who grow up in low and middle income families are roughly twice as likely to be overweight as kids who grow up in high income families. So these recommendations might be out of reach for the families who probably need them most. I mean, this is a bigger conversation about policy and health insurance and all of that, but like, how are we accounting for that fact?
Increased weight in children leading to obesity and overweight is one of the greatest health inequities in the country. Unequivocally, the least educated families, the least earning families are affected more. So it's a very serious problem that we must address for health equity across the country. Are they ready for this? Well, if explained appropriately and kindly and supportively, we hope that many families will be accepting of this. But sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it takes a while for them to accept the advice of a change in diet or a change in activity levels. There are some cultures that favor heavier weights, and that's not a problem by itself. But if it brings along comorbidities or complications of being overweight, that becomes a health problem.
And you kind of touched on this a little bit just now, but I guess I wanted to get at like how fragile this can be for teens especially, and how you might recommend doctors approach young children. Because even outside of this conversation about childhood obesity rates, I mean, we've been hearing about how damaging Instagram and TikTok can be, especially
oh, yes.
for young girls who are getting fed just, you know, reams of content about diet culture, how that can create certain stigma. And I guess, how do doctors need to think about that when they're approaching kids? Because, you know, I can see a situation where somebody is getting maybe bullied at school. They're getting fed all of this stuff on social media about how they need to look a certain way. And then, you know, their doctor and their parents are then coming and telling them that they need to look a different way. And that can be just devastating for kids. So how do you recommend that doctors and parents talk to their kids about this kind of stuff without, you know, adding to the emotional burden that it might cause?
Doctors are like other people. We have our biases. And if we cannot overcome those biases and not be weight-based biased, we shouldn't be treating children in terms of their weight. I never use the word obesity or overweight to any family. I talk about the daily habits that we might modify to improve health. If you can't be kindly in approaching the family, you shouldn't be treating this condition. So very careful discussion has not been shown to increase eating disorders or depression or other complications you might worry about, as you mentioned. Certainly, we have to be aware of these possibilities. Many children who are overweight or obese do have depression. We have to be very careful to approach that.
Well, Dr. Dennis Stein, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Michelle.
That's Dr. Dennis Stein. He's the Yochidei Chair of Pediatric Endocrinology and Professor of Pediatrics at UC Davis. Coming up, the battle of Super Bowl foods continues. Yesterday we talked about Philly cheesesteaks. Today, barbecue with a Kansas City barbecue judge.
But what they do is they run you through the process. So they say these are the categories: beef brisket, pork shoulder, pork spare ribs, chicken. And then you judge on a 9-point scale for three things: taste, texture, and appearance.
The history of American barbecue. That's next on Press Play. Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy, in for Madeline Brand. It's Super Bowl weekend with the Kansas City Chiefs set to take on the Philadelphia Eagles on Sunday. Yesterday, we had Evan Kleinman on the show talking about how to make the perfect Philly cheesesteak. And so today, in the interest of journalistic fairness, we're going to throw a little love to the most famous food tradition out of Kansas City, barbecue. A while back, I spoke with Adrian Miller. He's a James Beard Award-winning food historian, and he wrote a book called Black Smoke, African Americans and the United States of Barbecue. And we talked about how African Americans shaped one of America's favorite styles of food. Welcome to Press Play, Adrian.
Hey, thank you so much. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for being here. So the difference between grilling and barbecuing, I mean, we use these terms interchangeably, but I imagine that there's a specific difference here.
Yeah, so I think of, when I think of barbecue, I'm thinking about cooking meat over wood or charcoals, maybe a mix, for a long period of time. When I think grilling, I'm thinking high, intense heat, could be over gas, charcoal, wood, but it's really for a short period of time, you know, less than an hour. So when I'm thinking grilling, I'm thinking of like kebabs, you know, burgers, hot dogs, that kind of stuff. But barbecue is like, you know, some people say low and slow, but it usually involves some length of time.
Right. And so when you were writing this book, part of it was that you wanted to make sure that the history of African Americans in this space was being told, that legacy wasn't being erased. So was there a particular moment for you that really crystallized that feeling, that you felt like this legacy was being kind of wiped away?
Yeah, so I think the pivotal moment was for me is watching the Food Network in 2004, and Paula Deen's Southern Barbecue came on the air. It was an hour-long special about barbecue in the South, and I watched it, and when the credits were rolling, I realized that not one African-American was featured in that special. And so I thought, well, how does this happen? And then second thing, I thought, well, maybe I got it twisted. Maybe it was Paula Deen's Scandinavian Barbecue, and I had just misread the promo. So that caused me to look at other aspects of barbecue media, and that led me to see that the problem was really pervasive, that when it came to barbecue, African Americans were either depicted as bit players or left out of the story entirely.
But really, the legacy, I mean, goes back all the way, you know, to the arrival of the first Africans on the slave ship. So talk a little bit about that legacy and the role that African Americans have played in shaping this cuisine from the early days of the founding of this country.
Yeah, so early barbecue history is hazy because it's just not well documented. But the first time we hear about something called barbecue is when Columbus and his crew arrive in the Caribbean in the early 1490s, and they see the indigenous people in the Caribbean cooking in a way they hadn't really seen before. And eventually they called that barbacoa in Spanish, and then later it becomes barbecue in English. But what they saw were Native Americans cooking over a slow fire with a raised platform made out of sticks. And they were cooking iguanas, fish, and some other things. But that was different than the pit barbecue that evolved in the American South. So I really wanted to suss that out. And what I found is that barbecue, as we understand it, has a Native American foundations, because there was ways that Native Americans were cooking meat in the South, and eventually European colonists and enslaved Africans get involved in a process where it leads to what we call Southern or pit barbecue. By the time you get to the late 1700s, African Americans are clearly barbecue's principal cooks, because the early barbecue was very labor intensive. And so the racial dynamics of the time was like, if you're going to make people do a lot of work and not compensate them, African Americans were the ones to do that work.
Well, and the labor, I mean, when you say labor intensive, I mean, we're talking what, digging pits, sitting for hours in front of hot coals.
Yeah. So we're talking about finding the spot where you're going to have the barbecue, clearing all of the debris, then digging the pit, then chopping down the trees to create the wood that you would burn down into coals to put in that pit, and then killing all the animals, butchering them, and then butterflying them and sticking poles through the side so that they can be flipped on a regular basis, and then cooking them, seasoning them, serving it. And then even after that, enslaved African Americans were called upon to entertain the whites who attended these large barbecues. So it was like a Black experience from beginning to end. And it was only after all of that was done that African Americans themselves usually got to partake of the goods.
And in those meetings, after the parties wrapped and slaves were allowed to sit together and share the leftovers of these barbecues, these became a space for slaves to find community with each other. But they also drew the suspicion of a lot of the white slaveholders. How so?
Yeah. So during the antebellum period during slavery, typically on the large plantations, the work schedule slowed on the weekends. And so this allowed enslaved people to do things like cook barbecue, which is a long process. And often they were able to do this and build community, right? Because if you're going to cook a whole animal, you got to feed a lot of people. And these are the days before refrigeration. So you had to get a crowd to eat all that food. And it was a time for reinforcing social ties, being with family and friends, and sharing information. And what we know now is that some of the nearly successful slave rebellions were planned over barbecue. And so barbecue gets this community vibe, but also gets this resistance vibe. Because of the near success of those rebellions, we had some slaveholding whites or people who were sympathetic to the slave regime saying, hey, we got to keep Black people from barbecuing because you know, there's too much potential for rebellion.
So give us the broad overview of the book, Black Smoke. We talked a little bit about how this was sort of cementing the legacy of African-Americans in this space, in the barbecue space. But, you know, what were you really trying to get at with this book?
Black Smoke is about celebrating African-American barbecue culture and just restoring African-Americans to the center of the barbecue narrative in this country. And the basic idea is you can't talk about barbecue in the United States, at least in any kind of historical or traditional sense, without including African-Americans. So I just wanted African-American barbecuers to get more love.
And you talked a little bit about how this was an extremely labor-intensive art. And so we typically think of this as kind of the purview of men, but there were women in this space too. Talk a little bit about who those women were and the influence that they've had on this cuisine.
Yeah, so barbecue is often presented as dude food. And that really is just, it's just not the case in the Black community. I can even tell you personally, my late mother was the griller in chief in my family. And so Black women have long been in the barbecue game. So one of the great stories that I found that I was so happy to share was the story of Marie Jean, who was an enslaved African-American woman born in Arkansas when it was French territory. And there was an 1840 article about her superintending a barbecue in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. So superintending was the 19th century term for being a pitmaster. So dig that. An enslaved Black woman in charge of a barbecue, obviously telling dudes what to do. And you just see more examples of Black women, mainly after emancipation. But you see Black women involved heavily in barbecue. And even men who start barbecue restaurants would often say, well, I'm using my grandmother's recipes or techniques or my mother's recipe or techniques. So you see the influence of Black women throughout African-American barbecue culture.
Well, and you mentioned your mother. I mean, did she pass the cooking gene down to you? What did she teach you about barbecue?
You know what? Actually, I wasn't paying attention. I was so happy consuming that, you know, I didn't pay attention. So I actually started learning more about barbecue myself from my father, who obviously watched my mother all those years and had his own notion. So the barbecue grill has been passed to me just very recently.
Now you're a certified barbecue judge.
Yes. I got to tell you, that's the best conversation starter I've ever had. And I've done some very interesting things in my life, like work in the White House. And people say, oh, you worked in the White House? Oh, that's interesting. But you're a barbecue judge? I want to talk to you about that.
Well, how does one become a barbecue judge? And I guess as a judge, like what do you look for? Like what makes good barbecue good barbecue?
I am so glad you asked. I'm a certified judge in the Kansas City Barbecue Society. So you have to understand, barbecue is like boxing. There's a lot of different sanctioning bodies. So I'm in that one. So one day I walked into the room where they did the judging and, you know, there was about 70 people in the room. I was the only guy under 250 pounds. And so, you know, I accepted my future. But what they do is they run you through the process. So they say, these are the categories, beef brisket, pork shoulder, pork spare ribs, chicken. And then you judge on a 9-point scale for three things, taste, texture, and appearance. And then all of these sanctioning bodies have arbitrary rules. Like in the Kansas City Barbecue Society, you can only present your barbecue on certain greens, like green leaf lettuce, flat leaf parsley, and cilantro. So if you made the best barbecue in the world and presented it on collard greens, disqualified.
I don't know why the cilantro surprises me. I don't necessarily associate that with barbecue, but
yeah, you know, it's arbitrary, right? And then what they do is they bring out food to get you, so you can go through practice judging. They bring out something illegal on purpose just to see if you catch it. And they would say, well, Adrian, you should have noticed this. And then you stand up and you take a barbecue oath. I'm not going to repeat it because it's a sacred thing. And then a few weeks later, you get your badge in the mail. And at that point, you can judge in any sanctioned contest as long as you register in time. And so here's the interesting thing. When I started becoming a judge, there weren't many of us around. Now there are so many judges that it's like winning the lottery to actually be in a contest and judge now.
So since you're certified in the Kansas City Barbecue Society, can you only judge Kansas City style barbecue, or does the judging run the gamut?
So that's an interesting question. So when somebody competes in the KCBS, as the short term for it, they can make any kind of barbecue they want, really. So they can use any style, but you know, you're running a risk, because if you do a style that's not really popular or familiar with the contest is being held, you might not score too well. So typically people I find are making either Kansas, what I would call Kansas City style barbecue, Memphis style barbecue, or Texas, really like Central Texas. That seems to be what's most familiar. But most people do try to get that Kansas City vibe.
And do you have a favorite style?
Yes, mine is Kansas City. And that's a function of growing up in Denver, Colorado. So that was the closest place that had the strongest influence on the Denver barbecue restaurant scene. Although we had, you know, people from the Deep South, we had people from Texas and other things. I think Kansas City is what I gravitated to, because I'm a spare rib guy, and I like a thick tomato sauce that's, you know, got a little tang, a little sweet. So that's kind of my jam.
Do you have any, I mean, no pun intended, any hot tips on what people should be thinking about as they're looking to fire up those grills?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing I've been telling people more and more is just ditch the lighter fluid, invest in some kind of electric starter or something else where you're not putting all those chemicals on your briquettes. That's one thing. The second thing is fire management. You know, you have to be comfortable with managing your fire, so you're not opening up the grill every 10 minutes because you lose a lot of heat that way while you're cooking. And then I would suggest, no matter how you cook, if you can bring wood into the equation. So I cook with a mix of charcoal and hickory wood chunks. That's how I cook my barbecue. And then if you're going to sauce, just sauce at the very end, because the last thing you want to do is put sauce on it during the cooking process, because that's going to end up burning. And you don't want that.
Well, and I know sauce can be, I guess, a kind of controversial topic in the barbecue realm. Do you have a preference? What's the superior sauce for barbecue?
So my favorite commercial barbecue sauce is from Gates Barbecue out of Kansas City. I just think that strikes the right balance of thickness, tanginess, and being sweet, and a little bit of spice, depending on which version you get. So it just hits all the marks for me. Because, you know, there are a lot of sauces that just taste like ketchup. But I got to tell you, these mustard-based sauces from places like South Carolina and North Florida, they're growing on me.
How so?
Just the unusual tanginess. And it just seems to work well with things like chicken and even pork spare ribs. It's just an unexpected burst of flavor. And so one sauce that I think about a lot is a place called Jenkins Quality Barbecue in Jacksonville, Florida. Dig this. When they serve you ribs, they lay them all down on a row of white bread, and then they drench it with their barbecue sauce and wrap it all up. It's a sight to behold, and it's delicious.
All right. Well, Adrian Miller, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
That was Adrian Miller, author of the book Black Smoke, African Americans and the United States of Barbecue. Coming up, we'll remember KCRW DJ Eric J. Lawrence, who passed away yesterday. His knowledge of all things music was nothing short of encyclopedic, and he was a regular on this show. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy, in for Madeline Brand. Well, it's a sad day here at KCRW. Our former music critic and DJ, Eric J. Lawrence, passed away yesterday. He was 52 years old. Eric, who went by EJL, was a fixture on this show, Press Play, and he often came on the show to share his love and knowledge of all kinds of music. So we're going to remember him today. A while back, he spoke with Madeline Brand about the year 1991 and why it was such an important year for rock music.
You know, a lot of college rock stations were a little bit wary of major label releases, wanting to just sort of spend more of their airtime on sort of the lesser known bands. But, you know, there was a recognition that this was a sound that was captivating. There was starting to become this new heavy rock sound that incorporated kind of the from a generation that listened to their parents' classic rock records, but also from their own experiences with punk rock, and kind of melded the two to create something that was different and was more personal, maybe more political. And so we recognized that it was something that people were going to be interested to hear. And we were, of course, terribly excited when the mainstream sort of caught up with that idea.
Breathing, rest his head on a pillow made of concrete again. Oh, feeling, maybe he'll see a little better Saturday.
Eric's passion for music started long before he came to KCRW, when he served as a DJ and general manager at UCLA Radio, where he played bands like Pearl Jam and Nirvana. Decades later, Eric took his love for music and earned a graduate degree in literature with a focus on music. That made him the perfect guest to talk about Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2016.
He is not just a poet, right? You know, I think he sort of blanched a little bit at the notion of winning the Nobel Prize for Literature, because it is so unlike what traditionally they give that award to, people that write poems. No, he writes songs, and songs are another beast. There are words to them, but there is a musical component, and the music really does make a difference. This is also goes to the idea of, you know, his voice. A lot of people have difficulty with his voice, and he, I'm sure, would be the first to admit that his voice is not the greatest instrument of all time. But he's able to evoke so much with his voice, and in this stage of his life and career, this sort of wizened, grumpy old man kind of voice on occasion. And so when he sings some of these songs that, you know, evoke kind of violent, active imagery, it sounds, the wit comes through, this notion of this kind of grizzled old man with his pencil-thin mustache saying these words. That's part, I think, of his charm a little bit, is the fact that I'm not sure that he takes himself very seriously.
In this world so badly bent, how can I redeem the time? A time so idly spent, how much longer can it last? How long can it go on? Embrace my love, put down my head, and I cross the Rubicon.
Eric also shared with us many of the songs that got him through the long days and nights he spent studying. Here he is talking about one of his favorite artists, the late New Orleans legend, Dr. John.
Sort of his early persona as he was sort of developing his own sound as a solo artist was kind of as this voodoo witch doctor. And so that's sort of where the doctor component came in. What's ironic is he was actually given a honorary doctorate from his hometown university, Tulane, not that long ago.
So he actually was a doctor.
He is actually a doctor. I will say, I have a personal interaction with him in that there was a concert of his that we were presenting, KCRW was presenting, and oftentimes we have a DJ go to introduce the show. And so I went to do that. And that's always a little bit of a nerve-wracking experience to be out there in front of people that, you know, really have no desire to see you. They just want to see the show start. So I'm sort of pacing around backstage, and he sort of comes up from the wings, and I think he sees me. And he doesn't say anything, but he sort of, you know, nods in my direction and shakes his gree-gree stick at me. So I sort of got the benediction from Dr. John, and that made it all go
Excellent.
Down easy.
And that Dr. John song that got him through grad school, it's called Let's Make a Better World. Well, Eric, you made this world better, and we'll miss you.
Everybody, let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody, let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody, let's all begin. Do our thing. Make a better world to live in. Everybody, let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody, let's sing, sing, sing. Everybody, let's
That does it for us on Press Play. Thank you for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.